From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
I think we are all here today to mourn a very unjust death.
Around the world, people are protesting the police killing of an unarmed 23-year-old anti-globalization protester in Genoa, Italy. Here at home, Public Citizen accuses the drug industry of falsifying research costs while spending millions to fight lower drug prices, and we'll look at how academics collaborate with the military. All that and more coming up on Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. In Bonn yesterday, ministers from 178 countries hammered out a compromise agreement on a treaty that for the first time would require industrialized countries to cut emissions of gases linked to global warming. The agreement was announced after 3 days of marathon bargaining and rescued the 1997 Kyoto Protocol from oblivion after the U.S. rejected it in March. The weakened agreement made concessions to Japan, the world's second largest polluter, whose opposition would have killed the accord. As expected, it was the U.S. alone that rejected the new agreement. The agreement is a binding contract among industrialized countries under which they must reduce their emissions by the year 2012 or face tougher emissions goals. Delegation members heckled the U.S. representative when she rose to speak. European states yesterday threw their weight behind a compromise plan to toughen a 30-year ban on weapons of germ warfare. It fears the United States was prepared to block any deal. U.S. officials said in Washington over the weekend the Bush administration had problems with a proposed protocol to the Biological Weapons Convention aimed at making it enforceable. The plan, the result of years of painstaking international bargaining on a set of legally binding rules, was due to be further refined during a month of negotiations in Geneva before a full convention meeting set for November. The U.S. is the only country among the more than 140 that have signed the 1996 convention that has said it will reject a strengthening of the accord. Negotiators at the United Nations yesterday adopted the first global agreement on curbing illicit sales of small weapons, but only after seeing most of its teeth removed by the United States. The UN Secretary General Kofi Annan nonetheless described the text that emerged as an important first step towards ending the illegal trafficking of small weapons, which, according to the UN, have killed 4 million people since 1990. The UN Accord, which is not legally binding on any of the UN's 189 member nations, calls on manufacturers to keep detailed records of their sales and mark their small weapons so that illegally traded guns can be traced. It was adopted by consensus. The U.S. announced at the outset it would kill any agreement that implied any restriction on the right of people to carry weapons. It also refused to accept provisions that would have barred governments from selling small arms to non-state actors, which really meant rebel groups. With the Bush administration moving briskly toward a missile shield, a group of national security experts in the Democratic Party is pushing congressional Democrats to unite around an alternative that they contend would be less costly and less threatening to arms control agreements. Many Democrats contend the Republicans are successfully equating support for missile defense with support for the military in general, and by extension, casting opponents of missile defense as weak on defense. To seize control of the debate, the Democratic experts and a group of Democratic lawmakers are trying to devise a missile plan that could defend the country against very limited attacks from small nations like North Korea or Iran, but that would not be extensive enough to undermine the deterrent power of Russia or China's nuclear arsenals. The U.S. House of Representatives passed a measure yesterday that would require the FBI to report how it uses the controversial email wiretap system, formerly known as Carnivore. But the bill places no restrictions on how the FBI could actually use its monitoring system, now known as DCS 1000, developed to intercept the email and other online activities of suspected criminals. Carnivore has come under fire from lawmakers and civil liberties groups who say it is too invasive. This news from South Africa. Dr. Wouter Bassan, the head of chemical warfare under the former apartheid government, took the stand to defend himself against criminal charges of drug dealing, fraud, and murder. He testified he had infiltrated anti-government groups and traveled abroad in the 80s to acquire information, technology, and equipment to build the country's biological warfare arsenal. Bassan, who has been on trial for 22 months, has been accused of injecting poison into prisoners and using government laboratories to make the drug ecstasy. This news from Colombia. A retired army general with alleged links to right-wing death squads was arrested yesterday. Former General Rito Alejo del Rio faces charges of supporting paramilitary groups during his 1995 to 97 tenure as an army commander in northwest Antioquia state. He would be the first Colombian general tried before a civilian court for ties to the paramilitaries. That's militias linked to the armed forces waging a brutal massacre campaign against suspected leftist rebels and civilians. Monday's arrest, criticized by some human rights groups as a PR move, comes as the U.S. Congress considers new aid for Colombia in addition to the $1.3 billion package approved last year. Cracking down on army officers who work with the militias is one of several conditions supposedly governing U.S. military aid to Colombia's security forces. And finally, producers of CBS's Late Show with David Letterman canceled musician Ani DeFranco's scheduled appearance last week after DeFranco refused to substitute a more upbeat song for one about white fear and racism. Well, you may not hear it on Letterman, but you do hear it on Democracy Now! When I interviewed DeFranco in April, she started off by describing her song, Subdivision, and then we even let her play it. Let's go back to the interview. Ani DeFranco here on Democracy Now! Talking about divisions, you're one of the few white singers who take on the issue of race, and in your latest double CD in Reckoning, you have a song called Subdivision.
Yeah, well, I think it's, you know, everybody has a color, you know. we're all color, and I think it's very important for white people to talk about racism. Just because it, well, I was going to say because it doesn't affect us directly, but it affects all of us. And in fact, that song, Subdivision, is about how things as insipid and as racism affect everything right down to the architecture. For instance, in the city that I grew up in Buffalo, New York, there's been so much white flight to the suburbs. You know, it's kind of, Buffalo is sort of a mini Detroit, you know, and all of the money has moved out of the city, and they've just abandoned the city to utter dilapidation, and it affects the very fabric of the city, as there's so many abandoned buildings that are just being torn down rampantly, and it's just all racism, and it's a problem that we all need to address.
Could you sing it?
Sure. All right, then. White people are so scared of black people. They bulldoze out to the country and put up houses on little loop-de-loop streets. And America got its heart cut right out of its chest. And the Berlin Wall still runs down Main Street, separating East Side from West. And nothing is stirring, not even a mouse in the boarded up stores and the broken down houses. So they hang colorful banners off all the street lamps just to prove they got no manners, no mercy and no sense. And I wonder what it will take for my city to rise. First we admit our mistakes, and then we open our eyes. The ghosts of old buildings are haunting parking lots in the city of good neighbors that history forgot. I remember the the first time I saw someone lying on the cold street. I thought, I can't just walk past here. This can't just be true. But I learned by example to just keep moving my feet. It's amazing the things that we all learn to do. And so we're led by denial, like lambs to the slaughter, serving empires of style and carbonated sugar water in the old farm roads, a four lane that leads to the mall. And our dreams are all guillotines waiting to fall. And I'm wondering what it will take for my country to rise. First we admit our mistakes, and then we open our eyes. Or nature succumbs to one last dumb decision, and America the beautiful is just one big subdivision.
Ani DeFranco singing Subdivision, the song you didn't hear on David Letterman. Shame on you, David. It's from her latest CD, Reckoning, Reveling, here on Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. Public Citizen has accused the pharmaceutical industry of overstating the costs of developing new drugs while it spends millions of dollars to lobby against legislation that would rein in prescription drug prices for senior citizens and others burdened by soaring drug costs. The report, released yesterday, adds fuel to congressional calls for sweeping reforms of drug prices, including drug benefits for seniors on Medicare. The report also comes at a time when the American pharmaceutical industry and the Bush administration are waging an all-out campaign against poorer nations such as Brazil and South Africa that want to manufacture generic equivalents of life-saving drugs. We invited representatives of the Pharmaceutical Research Manufacturers of America numerous times on the show, but they declined. They've denounced the findings of Public Citizen Report and criticized its methodology. We are joined by Frank Clemente, who is head of Public Citizen's Congress Watch that put out the report. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
It's good to have you. Well, why don't you start off by summarizing your findings?
Sure. Actually, there were two reports that we issued yesterday, Amy. One was we called RxR&D Myths, and that is a report that looked at the claims that the drug industry has made over the years about how much it costs to develop new drugs. The chief finding was that they claim that it costs about $500 million to develop a new drug. We looked at it different ways and found that it's at most about $110 million and possibly as low as $57 million, depending on how you look at it. And that includes both the successes and the failures.
How did you find out the real costs?
Well, the government helped us with that. In 1993, the Office of Technology Assessment, which has been disbanded. The Republican Congress disbanded it in 1995 because they didn't like the types of reports it was issuing. They actually looked at the key study that the drug industry had been using and had been touting as for their number, for the $500 million number. And the Office of Technology Assessment did a very significant analysis of it and a critique of it. And they critiqued the methodology for two reasons. One was the industry was not deducting the substantial tax deductions that they get. They were not, in other words, they weren't subtracting that from what they said they spent on research and development, and that tax deduction is worth a third, 34 cents on the dollar, so they were not subtracting that when they did their first calculation. And also the industry was calculating the opportunity cost of capital. In other words, the money that was foregone if they weren't investing it in other things. And that would be sort of like me buying a new car at $20,000 and actually telling you that I was paying $40,000 because over the lifetime of the car, it actually was worth $40,000 if I had used the $20,000 I'd used to buy that car on other things, put in the stock market, and use it for investments. And we think that's not a fair way to look at it. They weren't actually looking at what it actually costs them to buy these to produce these new drugs.
Can you talk about the level of government support for research and development of drugs by the drug industry?
Yeah, this is probably one of the more significant things about the study we released yesterday. We were able to secure from the National Institutes of Health, that's the government agency that funds a tremendous amount of drug research and healthcare research in general. They had done an internal study in the last year, which they had not publicly released. We had to do a Freedom of Information Act request to get it. They decided to look at how much our taxpayers devoting, how much of our resources are going into the development of some new drugs. They chose 1995 as the year, and they looked at the top five selling drugs in that year. Those are the top five blockbuster drugs. They were $1 billion in sales each for each of these drugs. And they just started from scratch and dissected what were the key studies that had gone into the development of these drugs. And they found a shocking thing, I think way much more than we realized and than most analysts realized. They found that that 55% of the research that went into the development of those drugs was taxpayer-funded, U.S. taxpayer-funded. About 30% was funded by foreign academic institutions, and only about 10 to 15% was actually funded by the private drug industry, which were the ones that were profiting from these five blockbuster drugs.
We're talking to Frank Clemente, who heads up Public Citizens Congress Watch, that put out these two major reports yesterday. One of them, RX R&D Myths, the case against the drug industry's R&D scare card. That's research and development. It's interesting that consumers in the United States pay the highest costs in the world for prescription drugs, nearly 60% more than in Canada and Europe, and several times what people pay in poorer countries. How does your research explain this?
Well, we didn't actually look at that question. We've looked at that in previous studies we've done. I mean, the basic reason for the price disparity is that every other civilized government, or I don't want to say civilized, every other advanced government, developed government, is negotiating drug prices with the industry. The U.S. is the only one that doesn't. It's very similar to the fact that we are the only advanced country that does not have a national health insurance program either. What's ironic about this is that, let's just talk about the Medicare program, because that's what the debate in Congress has been about, whether or not Medicare should provide a prescription drug benefit to 39 million seniors and people with disabilities. Right now, the Medicare program negotiates or sets prices for hospital care for folks. It also negotiates with the doctors, with physicians and other individual providers, and basically sets rates or prices for people who get care from them. What it doesn't do is negotiate with the drug companies about what the prices should be for these life-saving drugs that people are taking. It just seems it's rather odd to us. If the Veterans Department, the Defense Department, the Indian Health Service, they all negotiate drug prices with the industry. HMOs, private insurance companies, they negotiate drug prices with the industry. Here we are, Congress is debating or about to debate whether or not to have a prescription drug benefit for Medicare. And quite frankly, most Democrats at this point in time have been unwilling to stand up and say that Medicare should have the authority to negotiate drug prices with the industry, because the industry is very powerful. As the second report that we put out yesterday, we called it the Other Drug War, Big Pharma's 625 Washington lobbyists, shows this is an industry that is a head and shoulders above any other industry in terms of the number of lobbyists they have here in Washington, the amount of spending they are doing to influence the public policy debate in Washington.
Frank Clemente, we have to break for stations to identify themselves, but I'd like you to stay on the line so we can talk about that other study. But I also want to ask you about how drug companies receive huge financial incentives for testing the effects of drugs on children. That's all coming up on Democracy Now! We're also going to be hearing the sounds of the streets protest yesterday around the country for the Italian police killing of a young protester in Genoa. And we're going to be talking about professors who collaborate with the military. That's all coming up on Democracy Now! We'll be right back.
I think I'll pass on that for this. I think we ought to try and know about these.
You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Our guest is Frank Clemente, head of Public Citizens Congress Watch. Yesterday, the group put out two new studies accusing the pharmaceutical industry of overstating the costs of developing new drugs while spending millions of dollars to lobby against legislation that would rein in prescription drug prices for senior citizens and others burdened by soaring drug costs. Again, we invited the pharmaceutical lobby group to be on the program, but they declined. Frank Clemente, one of your findings involves the testing of children, drug companies receiving a huge financial incentive for testing the effects of drugs on kids. What is that about?
This is an important issue in the sense this is the first test that the U.S. Senate will have this year on the drug pricing issue. It's this obscure term, it's called pediatric exclusivity. What that means is the drug companies back in 1997, Congress granted them the ability to get a six-month extension on their already long patents. These are monopoly patents that they have. They gave them a six-month extension on those patents in exchange for the drug companies agreeing to do a test to test how the effect of their drugs on children. And from our point of view, this is a huge giveaway. It's worth about $29 billion over 20 years to the drug industry. And all the industry is doing is, in exchange, is doing something that, in our opinion, they ought to be doing anyway. And that is, if a drug is going to be used to treat children, is going to be useful for the treatment of children, as part of their application to get the drug approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, they should be required to do testing of that drug on children, just as they do testing of the effects of that drug on adults. They oppose that. This is something that costs them a couple of million dollars, perhaps, at the most, to do these tests for we're talking billion-dollar drugs, and they're refusing to do that. I would say if any of your listeners are in the Connecticut area, in the state of Connecticut, Senator Christopher Dodd is the chief. He's carrying the water for the drug industry on this. His bill, it's the one that's going to be debated in the Senate, and he needs to hear from folks' phone calls saying, do not give this drug, do not do this giveaway to the drug industry. It's called pediatric exclusivity. Get something in return.
Frank Clemente, the other report you did, the other drug war, Big Pharma's 625 Washington lobbyists, who are they?
Well, it's a who's who. You know, it's Haley Barbour, the former head of the Republican National Committee. It's 21 former members of Congress. It's 200, almost 300 former staff of Congress, many of them chiefs of staff, many of them were chief counsels on the committees that write the drug legislation or write the patent legislation that gives the big breaks to the industry or gives the tax huge tax breaks to the industry. Some of them used to work at the Food and Drug Administration. They're from all across the government, but the important thing is it's a huge revolving door. More than half of these 625 lobbyists formerly were in, were either members of Congress or were in senior positions in the government. This is the most comprehensive and authoritative study that's ever been done. We built a huge database to look at these folks. Last year we did a similar study, and at that point in time we only had about 300 lobbyists. We took a narrower cut on it, but we decided to everybody who's employed by the drug industry, and we did a, this database was able to tell us how many folks are lobbying on prescription drug price issues and how many were lobbying on the Medicare drug benefit issue, because those are the two big things that go to the heart of what this industry is trying to protect, the profits that they're trying to protect. They don't want to have a Medicare drug benefit delivered through the Medicare program, because their fear is that Medicare logically will then demand to negotiate cheaper drug prices. And so that's what they've put most of their firepower into. And it wasn't just a ground war army of all these lobbyists. As you may know, they spent $65 million in the last election cycle running issue ads, the bulk of which were campaign-oriented issue ads actually designed to elect or defeat candidates. And that was an unprecedented activity on the part of the drug industry. They were really playing hardball with that.
You also point out that the drug industry continues to expand its influence. You're just getting new figures now. The drug industry contributed $625,000 to the Bush-Cheney inaugural. And what about the figures that are coming out right now with money going in as we speak?
Well, actually, the new numbers are just coming out. We don't have a read on them. What I can tell you from the last presidential cycle in 96 up till the 2000 presidential cycle, they more than doubled their contributions. They went from $9.5 million up to more than $20 million. The interesting thing about this money and the most disturbing thing about it is it's what's called soft money. That is that's the issue that's being debated when you hear the McCain-Feingold bill in the Senate and the Shays-Meehan bill in the House. It's trying to ban those types of contributions, Amy. Those are the five- or six-figure checks, sometimes $1 million checks, that come from the corporation, from the treasury of the corporation, and they go to the political parties. And what we found is that 59% of the money that the drug industry is contributing is now this soft money. I would imagine that in another 4 or 8 years, 80 or 90% of their contributions could be in the form of soft money. The reason we're trying to get rid of soft money is because it's such huge contributions. It dictates the terms of the debate. They work hand in glove with the leaderships of the parties. And in the case of the drug industry, the Republican Party, the last election cycle, 75% of their contributions were being steered towards Republican Party committees or Republican candidates. And that's no accident. It's that's who they've worked closest with in terms of formulating legislation that the drug industry wants and not what seniors want.
Frank Clemente, clearly these reports illustrate the ability of the drug industry to shape public policy and media coverage in its favor, despite the overwhelming support for lower prices by the public. How do congressional offices respond to this onslaught from the pharmaceutical industry? Were you able to talk to congresspeople about this?
Well, I mean, there is a bunch of members of Congress who are extremely sympathetic to this, to the thrust of the reports that we did yesterday. There's a majority of Democrats in the House, for instance, that have supported a bill. It's a bill by Representative Tom Allen. And that would permit the Medicare beneficiaries to be able to get the lowest price that the drug companies offer to other purchasers. And that probably would amount to a 40 or 50% price cut. It's not a benefit bill, but it's a price cut bill. And that's a very hopeful sign if you're getting over 150 members of Congress, Democrats, supporting such a position. The problem is you have this problem is, in the House, Democrats don't control things, so they don't control what bill comes up, and the Republicans have the vote to pass it there. The more interesting place for the debate is in the Senate. And the problem there is you have probably 10 to 15 moderate to conservative Democrats, and the John Bros of the world. You've heard his name before. And those folks are able to dictate the bill that the Democrats that are able to bring forward. I think in their heart of hearts, Tom Daschle and other Ted Kennedy and other leading Democrats would be willing to bring a bill forward that both provides strong Medicare coverage and also allows the Medicare program to negotiate deep price cuts with the industry. Their problem is they can't get the 51 Democrats to support that position. They can get maybe 40 or so, and that doesn't give them enough to put the bill on the floor and prevail. They would lose. And so what we're faced with is a Congress that is just, where you've got a lot of Democrats who aren't working on the side of consumers. They're working on the side of the drug industry.
You're very specific about naming people in your report, Newt Gingrich and others. Can you talk about, for example, Gingrich's role?
I recall us talking about Gingrich in the report. Did we...
More talking about the people who worked for House Speaker Newt Gingrich people who worked for Orrin Hatch, the former Senate Judiciary Chair.
Yeah, well, these are the types of folks who, have been in charge of writing legislation. I mean, there's an interesting person that we very briefly mentioned in the report. His name is Nick Littlefield. He's now registered to lobby for Amgen, which is a biotechnology company. He's a former chief of staff to Senator Ted Kennedy on the the Labor Committee, which has jurisdiction over the Food and Drug Administration. And frankly, he's running around Congress pushing a bill that's a drug industry bill, trying to get Ted Kennedy and other folks to support more of a privatized form of Medicare so that the drug benefit were delivered through the insurance companies and the HMOs rather than through Medicare. And the idea there is that you don't have Medicare as the big purchaser able to negotiate deep price discounts. You have what is currently, which is the insurance companies and the HMOs, a fractured market. Not all 39 million Medicare folks would be under it negotiating prices, and so you don't get the kind of price discount. And you get a very uneven set of benefits through that process, too. But you have folks like that who have been insiders for, you know, for a decade on the Hill with very powerful members of Congress on both the left and the right influencing the process.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Frank Clementi. Again, the two reports that came out yesterday, one, the other drug war, Big Pharma's 625 Washington lobbyists and Rx R&D myths, the case against the drug industry's R&D scare card. Website where people can get this information?
www.citizen.org.
Frank Clementi, head of Public Citizens Congress Watch. And you are listening to Democracy Now! As we move on now to the protests that have been taking place around the world, Italian police killed a 23-year-old protester and injured some 500 people at the G8 summit in Genoa, Italy last week. Since then, people all over the world have been taking to the streets in protest. 500 people gathered in front of the Italian parliament yesterday calling for the resignation of the police chief and the interior minister, directing cries of fascists to police in riot gear surrounding them. Inside, parliament debated the violence. The interior minister defended the policeman's actions, claiming that, quote, to defend himself from something that looked like it was turning into a lynching, the policeman fired two shots without aiming. Carlo Giuliani was shot twice in the head before police ran him over with an armored vehicle. People have also held protests in London, Sweden, Prague, Belgrade, Athens, and in cities in the United States. In Portland, Oregon, yesterday, 200 people tried to gain access to the Italian consulate to deliver a letter, but were denied entry, and two people were arrested. And here in New York, some 200 people gathered outside the Italian consulate as well. Our producer, Chris Abrams, was there, and here are some excerpts.
Just death. And we are also trying to point out to the world that when those who call themselves and assign themselves the place of our leaders, these are our leaders who have turned 16,000 police against us. They have put the Navy, the Army, at red alert. That is an outrage. These were unarmed citizens of the world expressing their outrage with a system that gives to the few in great abundance and takes from the many with ruthlessness. It is a ruthless system, and we are here to mourn those of us who stand drawing attention to the poor of the world. And for President Bush or for Mr. Blair, for them to stand there and say that they represent the poor, and that if we do not have the kind of free trade that they recommend, that in fact we are the ones who are against the poor, the ones who protest, who are indeed ourselves poor. We come out there because we are disenfranchised, and we come out there in order to claim our right to a citizenship on this planet.
The Times says this is the first death in an anti-globalization demonstration, completely overlooking and overlooking in a racist manner. In fact, the three executions in Papua New Guinea just a few weeks ago, 13 people were killed in Bolivia a few months earlier than that. People have been dying in the fight against corporate power across the world for years, you know, both here, but particularly around the world, where people have fought IMF and World Bank plans in South Korea, in Zimbabwe, in throughout Latin America. So we should both, you know, stand with the protesters and oppose the racism and, you know, vigilant defense of corporate interests that passes for journalism in the New York Times, the Daily News, and the New York Post. And also, I think that when you look at the protests, you see them both employing the vicious repressive strategy of attacking the movement and, you know, coming up with phony social solutions like this AIDS fund, which even Kofi Annan says is only potentially 1/7 of the money needed to fight AIDS. They said they invited poor countries to meet with them. You know, so they're trying to diffuse our movement's power from different angles, and it's up to us to take them on both fronts, both politically in terms of remaining united, but also in terms of getting out our message to a wider audience.
My name is Chris. I'm here with a bunch of different groups, with Dan. I'm also a labor activist. And I was out here on Friday and came back today. This could have been me, I think. That's why I'm here. It could have been any one of a dozen people I know. It could have been somebody here.
I'm from ACT UP, and I came here today because I've been doing direct action with ACT UP for many years. I heard about Carlo Giuliani, and I realized that could easily have been me, and it could easily be any of you. We have to be aware of the fact that they are raising the stakes when it comes to direct action. Here in New York, people are not being held for hours in jail. They are being held for days. They are not being charged with misdemeanors. They are being charged with felonies. And overseas, they're shooting people. We have to realize that when they say that they're going to raise the stakes, are we going to back off? I ask you, are we?
No!
Are we going to raise the stakes right back on them?
Yeah!
Carlo Giuliani is a symbol of the death that the WTO brings to the world. The WTO is fighting to help drug companies prevent people with AIDS in Africa and around the world from getting cheap drugs because it might hurt their patents. Are we going to allow them to do that kind of thing?
No!
I ask you to join with me. I'm also Italian-American. I am today ashamed to be an Italian-American. And I ask you now to call them on what they did and to say to the Italian government and to the WTO, shame!
Chants of protesters in the street in New York outside the Italian consulate yesterday, thanks to Chris Abrams, our producer, who was there as there were protests around the world. We come back from our break. We'll be joined by Professor David Noble, as many supposedly non-lethal weapons, such as those used against protesters in Genoa, were developed by academic researchers working in collaboration with the U.S. military. We're going to talk about the relationship between the U.S. government, specifically the military, and academics in this country. Stay with us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Democracy Now! Free Speech Radio. And for those of you who heard the musical interlude, it's Preparing for Battle from the soundtrack of Planet of the Apes. Yesterday, we discussed two examples of how academics and corporations collaborate with the military. A few weeks ago, the British magazine New Scientist published an article about how the Pentagon is searching for a new crowd control weapon, a non-lethal stink bomb. Cognitive psychologists and neuroscientists funded by the military have joined forces to find a smell that will terrify people so much they have no choice but to run from the scene. And the National Research Council has just published a new study, which we talked about yesterday, called Opportunities in Biotechnology for Future Army Applications. 17 scientists from universities and private research centers participated in the 118-page report. Well, we're joined today by telephone by Professor David Noble, who is a historian of science and technology at York University in Toronto. David Noble, this study, Opportunities in Biotechnology for Future Army Applications, recommends that the Army work more closely with the biotech industry and was put out by the National Research Council. Let's start off with that. What is the National Research Council?
The National Research Council is a private operation that was set up during World War I. It's the research arm of the National Academy of Sciences. And the history, the context of the history of these organizations is a military context. The National Academy of Sciences was founded in 1863 during the Civil War, and it was set up to provide military and scientific advice to the government. It was not used very much and became moribund by the turn of the century. But in the preparations for World War I, and the U.S. was a little late getting into that war, so there was a whole period of preparedness. The scientific community took advantage of this to try to get the state to help them organize the scientific resources of the country and put it to use for the military. And in 1918, at their prompting, Woodrow Wilson issued an executive order creating the National Research Council explicitly to organize research for the war effort, in such areas as anti-submarine warfare, naval gunnery, communication, gas masks. World War I was a chemist's war, and we're seeing this now, the effects of this on the streets in cities all over the world. I was up in Quebec City, and it took me a month and a half to get that stuff out of my lungs. So the National Research Council, in its origins, was created in a military context and has always been primed for this kind of work.
I want to go back in time and look at the history of military academic collaboration, but I also want to talk about who you are and why we're talking to you in Canada. Now, we know a lot of people fled the draft during the Vietnam War and went to Canada, but you were a professor here in the United States, actually.
Right.
It was well after Vietnam, and ultimately, you were fired from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Can you talk about your experience there and the relations of professors there? I heard about a panel you were on in 1983 where you were with your colleagues and what you said about each of them, what you thought was most significant.
Well, what that panel was about was the relationship between corporations and universities, in particular the relationship between corporations and MIT. And people were talking and pontificating, as they usually do, about corporations and their influence or their generosity or what have you. And I like to sort of bring things home. So I just identified the corporate directorships of every other person on the panel, including the provost who was chairing the thing, really put in relief that we're not simply talking about two separate sectors, that they are fundamentally interrelated, and this is exactly what Dwight Eisenhower was talking about in his farewell speech about the military-industrial complex. It really was the military-industrial-academic complex. So that to look for the presence of corporations on a campus, you don't have to look for logos. You just check the resumes of the people who run the place, and you'll see that they are more at home in the boardroom than in the classroom.
So you ultimately lost your job there, though you were going for a seat that actually would...
No, no. At MIT, I was fired, and then I sued MIT. I was in court with them for almost 5 years, so I was able... The court gave me all the documents. And the concern at MIT was that I was making public a lot of these relationships with... primarily with industry as well as with the military, and publishing them in places like The Nation and other publications, and that really concerned them. I mean, the unstated rule is if you're in, you've got to keep your mouth shut, sort of like a gentleman's agreement. If you're outside, you don't know what's going on, so it's hermetically sealed, it's airtight, and I never subscribed to that agreement.
Now, you are also in the news in Canada now over a battle to be appointed as a professor at Simon Fraser University.
Right, right. And that's just another point on the same curve that what's unique about it, this is a chair, an endowed chair that's unique in North America. It's named after James Woodsworth, who was the founder of the CCF, the Cooperative Commonwealth Federation, the precursor of the National Democratic Party, the NDP, the third party in Canada, which was originally a Labour Party. And Woodsworth was one of the great radical leaders in Canada in the 20th century, began his career in jail during the Winnipeg General Strike. And they named the chair after him, and the endowment is provided by hundreds of workers and farmers and union locals across Canada. So it's the closest thing there is in North America to a people's chair, so to speak. The job description is to teach in the humanities, and I'm a historian half of the time, and then engage in social activism in the spirit of Woodsworth the other half. So I was sought out. I never applied for this job. I was just sought out and told that I was one of the finalists and invited to Vancouver for interviews, which I did, and then I was unanimously selected by the faculty for the job. Then the administration stepped in to block it. They hired an outside consulting firm, which is unprecedented for academic appointments, assigned the firm the job of contacting four people who are people I've written about. I mean, I've written about their activities critically, so, I mean, it was an obvious smear campaign. And in British Columbia, the law requires that they ask my permission before they talk to references, and so I refused to give it, and I wasn't going to participate in my own assassination. And then the administration blocked the appointment on the grounds that I refused to cooperate with the outside consulting firm. So it's caused quite a storm up in Canada, up here, and there's also been some press in the States, the Chronicle of Higher Education, and Lingua Franca, and other outlets. The Canadian Association of University Teachers, which is the umbrella federation of all faculty unions in Canada, is conducting its own independent inquiry as we speak, headed by the former premier of Manitoba, and that's scheduled to come out at the end of the month. But at the end of August. But it's not the only case of the abridgment of academic freedom. What's in a way nice about it is it really puts in relief and illustrates very clearly the question. Whose universities are they, the people's universities or the corporations' universities? And, of course, what the Simon Fraser folks are most concerned about is that my presence there would bring more light to bear on the array of relationships that university has with industry.
Well, in the time we have remaining, Professor David Noble, let's go back and look fully here in the United States at the collaboration between the military and academics. I mean, so often you have academics saying, no, I didn't make that bomb, whatever. I'm doing basic research.
Right.
Can you go back and look at that?
Well, yeah. I mean, very, very quickly. The real watershed is World War I, as I said, when the National Research Council was set up. That's when the chemists got into the business. It was mostly chemical warfare and also anti-submarine research. So it was a chemist's war. World War II was the big Big Bang, so to speak, because the physicists, as they call it, the physicists were got involved in Manhattan Project, you know, the atomic bomb, proximity fuses, ballistics, gunfire control. That's where we got all of our cybernetics and automation. Proximity fuses, miniaturization of electronics, the transistor, computers, all developed under the aegis of the Army and other military agencies. Aviation, operations research, all of it came out of World War II. Following World War II, as you know, we established a permanent war economy in the United States. And so in the midst of the Cold War, the academics were on contract to the military. Most of the research budgets of the major research universities were overwhelmingly DOD, development of especially space, ICBMs, counterinsurgency, under the auspices of the Office of Naval Research, which was the big one, and then followed up by the DOD agencies, ARPA and then DARPA, and that's where we get the Internet, for example. So throughout Korea, Vietnam, the Gulf War, the academics have been essentially a research arm of the military, always. However, during the 60s, there was an outcry, of course, because of the anti-war movement against the presence of the military on campus, especially the attack on classified research, that is, secret research, which was endemic. And universities were forced to ban, more rhetorically than real, ban classified research, and they played a shell game and sort of hid their military research off campus and sort of out of sight. But it continued, but in a muted way. I think during the Gulf War, what you're describing is perfectly apt. During the Gulf War, I did a study of fuel air explosives, which are called non-nuke nukes, which were used with great devastation, great effect in Iraq by the United States. These were developed at the end of the Vietnam War, and I looked at all the non-classified reports, which were done for the Air Force. They were all academics, and I called up, this is during the Gulf War, I called up all the academics and leading institutions in the United States to congratulate them. And nobody took credit for this devastation. They all said, oh, no, we didn't work on weapons. We worked on elevator explosions or working out the dispersion models of gases in the air or what have you. That is, in technical terms or scientific terms, even though they were taking money from the Air Force. And so the soundbite would be that in our age, weapons are made by people who don't make weapons. That is, the military has become very adept, and they learned this from early corporate research at the end of the 19th and early 20th centuries, on how to manage scientists, how to set up an organization that indulges their enthusiasms, gives them the illusion that they're following their own nose and doing their own thing. And the scientists will often say, oh, no, I get money from the Air Force, but they never tell me what to do. I'm free to do whatever they want. And in setting up the organization, they're able to take the results of this work and put it together to make weapons. And so none of the scientists have to in their own minds bear any responsibility. I mean, I call it criminal innocence. They would just have to fire three or four synapses in a direction that they're not used to, that is, in terms of social responsibility, to understand what they're involved in. But they don't do that. They avoid that like the plague, and they insist that they are completely innocent and they are completely autonomous, which is really the hallmark of modern warfare.
We're talking to Professor David Noble at York University about the history of military-academic collaboration. Noam Chomsky once referred to the backroom boys, which I guess are men and women, who do these kind of parts of the research that all add up together to the weapons. You're also looking in a new book, and we'll have a more extended discussion about this soon, but just to give people a sneak preview, at military-academic collaboration around long-distance or online learning.
Right. Well, let me before we go into that in just 2 seconds, I mean, what you talked about yesterday with the biologists and biotech getting involved with the Army, I think what we're seeing is a re-legitimation of open military work on the campus. That in the wake of the anti-war movement, it was something that had to be kept quiet. When Reagan tried to launch his Star Wars, there was a campus movement against it. I think now, with the unabashed declaration that space research is now going to be militarized by the Bush administration, I think we're going to see more and more open discussion and open research on the campuses in a military direction. I think that's what that report you talked about yesterday is about, legitimation of that activity. And we're going to see, again, classified military research on the campus with a vengeance. Now, what the distance education thing is about is the universities are undergoing a rapid transformation in their infrastructure and automation of this industry, just like the automation of many other industries, with the aim of reducing their labor bill, getting rid of professors, getting rid of essentially what happened to the healthcare system with HMOs, deprofessionalization of the physicians. Now we're going to see the deprofessionalization of the professoriate. With the delivery of courses online by adjunct professors and with a market presumably worldwide. The problem is that all the money, and we're talking billions of dollars that have been invested in this direction, the market has not materialized, and a lot of companies are going belly up. A lot of universities are really worried that they're not going to be able to get a sufficient demand for this. So what they did is they called in the cavalry, as they have many times in the past. This is a time-honored tradition in the U.S., to create the market for them. And the Clinton-Gore administration really authored this through their Advanced Distributed Learning Initiative, which came out of the White House. They got the Department of Defense, starting with the Army and then followed by the Navy and Air Force, to set up a program which totals about $1 billion, to provide taxpayer-subsidized distance education for active-duty personnel and eventually their families as well. So overnight, and we're talking about just in the past year, this was started in August of 2000, so it's just about a year now, the Department of Defense has become the largest consumer of distance education in the United States. And so the market has now been created. So the Secretary of the Army announced, this is last year's, okay, guys, he's talking to academics, you know, now you can go to your president and say, let's go with distance education because there's a guaranteed market, which is, again, a taxpayer-supported market through the military. But what this translates into, and really the bottom line in all this, is very serious compromise of the integrity and, I hate to use the word mission, it's a military word, of the universities, which I'm sorry.
Well, David Noble, we have to break now because we're coming to the end of the program, but we're going to have an extended discussion about this very soon because it's an issue I think that not a lot of people know about. David Noble, thanks for being with us, historian of science and technology at York University in Toronto, soon to be coming out with a book on online digital learning, long-distance learning. That does it for the program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams and Brad Simpson. Anthony Sloan is our engineer and music maestro. Errol Maitland is our technical director. From the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of the band and the Fired, from the studios of our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.